Today's Teisho is on case 91 in the Pien Lu, the Blue Rock Collection. Case 91 is entitled Enkan and the Rhinoceros Fan. Engo's introduction. Transcend delusive attachments, deceptive ideas, and all kinds of entanglements. Proclaim the marvelous teachings and uphold the precious treasury of the true Dharma. Secure the free command of the 10 directions and the perfect serenity of the 8 dimensions. Let the land of peace be realized. Now tell me, is there anyone who will go hand in hand with the Buddha, testifying to the same realization, living the same life and dying the same death? See the following example. Main subject. Enkan one day called to his attendant and said, "Bring me the rhinoceros fan." The attendant said, "The fan has been broken." Enkan said, "If the fan is broken, bring the rhinoceros to me." The attendant made no reply. Tosu, at a later time, speaking in place of the attendant, said, "I would not refuse to bring it out, but I fear the head and horns would not be perfect." Secho says, "I want that imperfect one." Sekiso says, "If I return it to you, there will be no more of it." Secho says, "There's still the rhinoceros." Shifuku drew a circle and wrote the character for ox in it. Secho says, "Why didn't you bring it out earlier?" Hofuku says, "My master, you have grown old. Employ someone else to attend you." Secho says, "Long labor lost." Secho's verse, "You have long used the rhinoceros fan. If asked, however, you know nothing of it. Infinite, the cool breeze and the head and horns, like clouds and rains which have passed, it cannot be captured." So let me just thank everybody for really excellent sitting this morning. Really excellent, deep, deep practice. You know, if you went to any Zen center in the United States, you know, you would not see better practice than here. You know, we sat for an hour and a half, you know. We had little breaks, and everybody was sitting absolutely still. It was so impressive. Really, really, that is excellent practice. People are in deep, it's day four of Sesshin. Day four of Sesshin, you know, is when the magic happens, right? It's like it takes 3 good days of practice to get into that deep, deep samadhi. You know, and this morning people were there. You know, it's like, you know, in one of the koans it says if you hit him with a stick, he wouldn't even notice, right? People were, it's such deep samadhi that is so impressive, so wonderful. You know, because our culture is so confused, you know, people don't realize just how amazing it is that human beings can do this. You know, that human beings have the capacity to do this. You know, I don't like people talking about meditation and the brain. I'm not particularly interested in that. But, you know, one of my good friends in the Seattle Zen Center was a brain scientist, John Sunston. And he was in the medical school there, and he was in charge of the neuroanatomy classes for the medical school. And he was one of the first people to do research on meditators' brains, you know. And he was involved with some studies, early studies, where people noticed that the brains of meditators were behaving very differently than the brains of non-meditators. And, he didn't do this, but one of his colleagues went to a temple in Japan and said, he said to the Roshi, who is the Shifu, who is your best student? And the abbot, the teacher said, this is my best student, this is my second best student, this is my third best student. I mean, it's a little ridiculous to rank people like that, but he did indicate who was most accomplished and experienced and who was least. And then when they looked at their brain patterns, it corresponded pretty much to what the teacher said. And, according to what I read, it said that, ordinarily our brains are just if you imagine a cloud in a summer sky, our brains are a little like that. And there's a flash of lightning up above, and then there's a flash of lightning down below, and then there's a flash of lightning to the left, and then there's a flash of lightning deep in the cloud, and it instead of being bright, it's gray. And that's sort of how our brains operate. But when we meditate, they're supposed to go into a state of deep synchronization, basically, it's called a gamma wave synchrony, where the brains, both of the hemispheres, start to work in sync, and you're in this state that's real, but it's not everyday consciousness. You know, it's a different. It's an enhanced consciousness. And one of the interesting things is that actually people who are around other people who are in gamma wave synchrony begin to be in gamma wave synchrony. That's actually something people have. So, when you get a bunch of people in a room and they're all in gamma wave synchrony, they have an effect on each other. It's not magical, but it's been well studied, So, I think that talking about the brain and meditation is somewhat interesting, but I actually think it's just one way of talking about what's happening. And it really doesn't get at what we experience on the cushion. I don't really think the mind and the brain are the same thing. In fact, there are people who say that the brain may not be the source of consciousness. The brain just may be like a radio receiver. It may pick up consciousness. There's actually serious people who say that. We don't have to necessarily accept that the brain is the whole story to consciousness. But the point is that our experience on the cushion is really different on day 4 of Sesshin than it was on day 1 of Sesshin. And you're in a state of heightened reality, I would say. In fact, I want to get off this brain thing, but I don't seem to be able to. But, these two scientists who were actually psychologists, one's a brain scientist and one's a psychologist, said that it's probably the case that when people are in this state that we're in today, of a deep concentration, deep that may be a more, they say, that may be a more accurate understanding of the real world than ordinary people have. And they talked about the fact that, you know, ordinary perception is very disorganized, and it's driven by all kinds of compulsions and wishful thinking. You know, and so, you know, ordinary consciousness is very, very flawed. You know, so people who think their ordinary consciousness is the closest they get to reality are actually quite mistaken. You know, people go through their day trapped in isolating self-consciousness. And they're constantly defending themselves against attacks, basically. You know, so you know, the ordinary self-consciousness is very defensive. And it's very closed up, right? I mean, everybody has this experience once in a while. You know, in my job, I have to give what are called talks, academic talks. And when I have to give a talk, usually there's like a panel of people. There's like three people giving a talk. Each person gives a talk, and then there's questions. And the first time I did this, I was just petrified with fear. Because in my mind, I thought I would give the paper and somebody would stand up and attack my views. And this has happened to me in my career. You know, I have had that happen, where I've given a paper and somebody stood up and said, you know, I find this, your argument, very unconvincing, blah, blah, blah. But fortunately, that didn't happen to me in my earlier life. And the first time I gave a paper, I was just so petrified with fear that I sort of read the paper mechanically. And then somebody did ask me a question, and he had to ask me three times because it was like his question wouldn't sink into my brain. And it was pretty much like he almost asked me the question, and then he told me how to answer it. You know, because I was so afraid, I was so nervous, you know. And I couldn't be intelligent under those circumstances, you know. It was hard for me to think because I was so closed up. And that's happened to me a number of times, you know. That's happened to me a number of times where I've been in such a defensive mode, right, that it's been hard to even be aware of my surroundings. And if you're quite nervous, you know, if you're in a situation where you're very nervous or you're very fearful, you know, it may be hard even to remember the details of what happened after the fact. And if somebody said, well, what did he say? I don't know if you've ever had this experience, but if you've ever been, had something bad happen to you and people aren't aware of it and they're talking to you, it's like they're not even talking, right? You're so absorbed in yourself. So it's definitely the case that ordinary consciousness is very flawed. And we live in this ordinary consciousness. And you know, we respond to, if we're in that state, when there are attacks, we can feel very threatened. And you know, very hurt and injured, and it confirms our worst fears, you know, and then we often behave in ways that are not very beneficial to anybody. You know, a lot of life involves wishful thinking, you know, like, you know, pursuing things that are not necessarily, don't really make any sense, right? So, a good example of this is like gambling, right? You know, when I was when I got out of college, I worked as a I worked in a restaurant as a cook. I hitchhiked out to Albuquerque, New Mexico, because I wanted to spend the summer backpacking. And I arrived in March, and I got a job as a cook at Mamma Mia's restaurant. It doesn't exist anymore. But it was an Italian restaurant in Albuquerque, and I started at $80 a week. This was 1977. So that wasn't big money even then, right? That was like barely survival wages. But now you couldn't survive on that. But anyway, let me see, I've lost track. Hold on just a second. What was I saying?
Gambling.
Ah, thank you. Ah, thank you, thank you. Okay, gambling, yes. I began to start making pasta again, so. Whatever happened to him, you know?
He's giving a talk.
So anyway, gambling. And Gary, his name was Gary, he was the head cook. He was not the chef, but he was the top. The cooks were ranked 1, 2, 3. I was 3. And Gary was number 1. And Gary was a gambler. And we went out. He said, "You want to go out and play poker?" So I went out to play poker. And these guys actually put serious money on the table. And as the game would go on, they would actually like up the ante. And at the end of the night, it wasn't like hundreds of dollars, but it was a significant, they said, "Well, do you want in?" And it was like, "No, you know, I have $80 a week, I don't want in. Do you have any penny? Can I play for a penny, you know?" But I was unwilling to take that risk. And I watched this game, and people were, when you lose, you put in more money, right? Because you say, "Well, I've already lost 100. I can't stop now, or I've taken a $100 loss." So you put in another 20, but what if you lose again? You know, then I can't stop now because I lost 120. And I actually watched this happen, you know, and thought, this is crazy, you know. I've seen this behavior before. This is wishful thinking, right? It is so much, so complicated. So the ordinary consciousness is very delusional, right? And, you know, we're in a state of mind that's quite different from that. You know, our mind, it generally speaking, even if you feel, you know, when you meditate, you don't necessarily feel sharp and clear. So you know, sometimes if you're a scientist and you're working on figures, you know, you may feel it's all sharp and clear. And also when you write, you know, sometimes if I have to write something, the words just come and it's all very lucid and it's clear. And sometimes if I have to speak in public, sometimes I'm just amazed. It's like, where is this coming from? It's so clear, you know. But you know, when you're meditating, it doesn't necessarily feel that way. The mind feels like dark or muddy, right? It can feel it's not quite dreamlike and it's not quite waking consciousness. And so you might think that this is this dark and rather imprecise mind is less intelligent than ordinary consciousness. But, you know, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that's not true. So you know, after 4 days of Sesshin, we're engaging with reality in a very different way. And you know, when people are able to enter deep samadhi, what that really means is that, I would say, is that your intelligence has changed, right? You're not just filtering, you're filtering less. You're taking in much more information, and your senses are more alive, right? Your senses, your hearing, your tasting, your touching, it's like the curtain has been taken, opened up, and now you're not looking through a curtain at reality. You're just experiencing reality, but you're also experiencing it without your self-consciousness being present. Your defenses are less present. You know, it takes a long time to have no defenses, right, or few defenses. But the defenses are less present, and also you know, your processing between your big mind and your small mind is like more connected. So ordinarily people are quite closed off and they're not able to access their big minds very effectively. But by now, on day four of Sesshin, people are able to, you know, be intelligently intuitive, right? You know, in other words, you're able to access your dynamic unconscious mind in a skillful way. And even though we think of intuition as totally natural, you know, it has to be cultivated. You learn how to hear the voice of your big mind and be open to it, right? And it takes practice. So, you know, koan training is like educating is learning how to use your big mind. You have it, you can access it, but how do you use it? And so koan training is like learning how to do that, learning how to be receptive. And that usually involves some struggle, right? Because it's difficult for people to surrender control. It's difficult for people to let the big mind take control. And also, because of that, it's hard sometimes to know what the big mind is trying to say. You know, so as I've mentioned before, people come into the Dokusan room and I'll say, "What's happening?" And they'll say, "Nothing." And I'll say, "Well, okay, you're not answering your koan, but tell me what is happening." But then they'll say something that's really the answer to the koan. And it's because they're looking for something else that they're not yet completely able to be receptive. This capacity to be open to the big mind requires a lot of zazen. And it requires the ability to sit very deeply. And this morning, everybody's sitting was so deep. You know, it's like, I can't see into your brains, but I do see what you present in Dokusan. And it's very clear to me, many people in this room have been practicing for a long time. And you have cultivated your awareness very assiduously, very carefully and with great determination. And you know, even though it's the case that out in the world people don't understand this, don't sell this experience short. Don't sell yourself short. You know, you have very finely tuned intelligence that's taken years to create. Anyway. So this is a koan that involves Zen Master Enkan. And he asked his attendant, his Inji-san, to get him the rhinoceros fan. And if you know anything about Zen ritual, in Japanese Buddhism, and this probably goes back to the Tang Dynasty also, when the Roshi delivers a teisho like this, he often brings in a fan and actually opens the fan up and sets the open fan down on the ground during the teisho. And when the teisho is over, he picks the fan up and retracts the fan, right? So this is a symbol of teaching. And in this case, the fan has a rhinoceros design on it. And this was very popular in Tang Dynasty China. The pictures of a rhinoceros were considered marvelous and amazing. And so the teacher, Enkan, calls for his attendant and says, "Bring me the rhinoceros fan." And the attendant says, "Oh, you know, I didn't tell you this, but the rhinoceros fan is broken." Now, maybe the master knows and maybe the master doesn't know. But the master then says, "If the fan is broken, this bring me the rhinoceros. It's a rhinoceros fan. If the fan is broken, bring me the rhinoceros." This is like if if you know Groucho, if you like the Marx Brothers, this is like a Marx Brothers joke. Bring me the rhinoceros. So, you know, the attendant is, of course, like stumped, right? And then what happens at the rest of this is comments from other Zen masters. They're all piping in and they're giving their... remember I said that Zen masters communicate in ways that are designed to help you open up another perspective. So each master is adding something here that like opens up a different perspective, opens up a different perspective, opens up a different perspective. It's like Zen practice is a little bit like somebody, the teacher's job in Zen practice, to put it a certain way, is like to pull the rug out from under you, right? And nobody likes to have the rug pulled out from under them. But then, you know, when the rug is pulled out from under you, you know, actually you go through an experience and you come out on the other side thinking, oh, you know, what do you know? My world is a bigger world. And so, you know, each Zen master is trying to pull the rug out from under the other Zen masters. And if it works, everybody wins. So it's not a... It's a win-win situation. The way you can help me is to show me something I haven't experienced yet. And in this way, learning goes on and on. Practice goes on and on. But the attendant is stumped, right? Probably feels a sense of like shame or failure or... embarrassment, you know, all of these emotions that we all have all the time, you know. When things don't go right, we freeze. You know, this is quite common, right? So, I have seen people in my workplace, you know, absolutely melt down, right? It's like, once this happened this fall, at the scheduling office gives us classrooms that we assign to our teachers. So every teacher is given two classrooms. Like you might have a Monday, Wednesday class and a Tuesday, Thursday class. And you're given your classroom, Scott Hall 101 for your Monday, Thursday, and the other class would be Frelinghuysen such and such. And you know, you're a teacher, you're getting your courses in order, you have your materials ready for the first day, and sometimes the scheduling office changes classroom assignments at the last minute, because this is Rutgers, right? And so they are supposed to post a notice, they're supposed to notify the teacher, and they're supposed to post a notice on the door. But a teacher, you know, came, who lives in New York, took the train down, got to her class on time, went into her class, and she said, well, you know, this is 101. And they went, no, this is French. And then, you know, this has happened to me too, you know. And then, you know, understandably, right, she flipped out. Like, oh my God, my students, you know, where are they? You know, and she went up and down the hallway looking for her class. And as she was going up and down, she was getting more and more upset, you know. And then she came into our office and she was furious, right? And also hurt, right? Like she felt undermined, like somebody pulled the rug out from under her, right? And these are all human emotions, right? They're all human emotions. This actually has happened to me. I had to be at a meeting in a new building at Rutgers. And because it's Rutgers, it's not a logical building, right? So there's like a first floor, a second floor, and then it's like the fifth floor, right? And you can't find the fourth floor, right? And so I'm supposed to meet these people on the fourth floor. So I went to the building, you know, I took the elevator up, you know, I got out, and I wasn't on the fourth floor, you know. It says four on the elevator, but I'm on the third floor. And, you know, I couldn't find the meeting, right? So I walked around, I asked people, nobody knew. I finally went back to my room, and I was so mad, you know. It was like, God damn it, you know. I later talked to a friend of mine, and he said, well, yeah, it is a funny building, you know. It's like the third and fourth floor are both on one floor. It really is true. There's 300 classrooms labeled 300 something and 400 something on whatever floor it was, right? And he said, yeah, it's a funny building. Yeah. And I was embarrassed, right? So, you know, we all react this way. But, you know, these moments are really valuable, the most valuable moments, right? They're the most valuable moments. If I had said, you know, room 401, and I had gone to 401, I would feel like, you know, I'm together, I know what I'm doing, I understand myself very well, you know, I've been practicing Zen for 40 years, it's all cool, you know. But then, you know, trying to find this room, this really happened to me. I came back and I just went into my room, my office, and I never went to the meeting. I had to apologize, and I didn't say I couldn't find the room, you know, but I said something came up, you know, and then I told my friends that, you know, what the hell, you know, I started, you know, ventilating, you know. So we all do this, but this is when we see something that we can't ordinarily see, right? We see our limitations. You know, we see our fear, we see our attachments, you know, so clearly. And this is the pivot. This is where we can change. This is where we can change. And this is why I think koan training is so wonderful. You know, it is possible that we could just enter deep samadhi day after day and, you know, calm the mind. That's a kind of meditation practice. But I think that the koan practice is so beneficial because it's when you are stuck, when you are, when you feel afraid, you know, suddenly you see your fear. You realize, I'm out of, you know, my poor friend who's worked with me for 20 years, when they did that to her, she wanted to be a good teacher. She wanted to go to the classroom and say, you know, hello class, you know, I'm so-and-so, and welcome to English 101, and these are the reading I want you to read. It's really an interesting reading. And she'd ask them what their majors are, and so on and so on. And instead, it was like this nightmare, and she had this image of the students sitting there waiting for her to show up, and so their first impression of her is like she can't even find the goddamn classroom, you know. So, but that's where you see it, right? That's where you see it. You know, when you have those moments, you can grow. You can change. You're seeing your limitations. There's no other way to see them. You know, if you had asked me, about my limitations, I wouldn't have understood how much frustration I would feel not being able to find that classroom. And actually, you know, guilt, questions about my own competence, you know. I mean, I'm over 60 years old, you know, so one of the things I'm anxious about is that people will think I'm an old fool, right? You know, actually, that sounds, you know, crazy, but I do worry about that, you know, that you get to a certain age where people are just think if you make a mistake like this, it's because you're an old man, you know, you couldn't even find the room, right? And I'm sensitive about that, and I saw that when this happened. Right? I mean, the fact is, when I was 30, I couldn't find rooms either, right? But now that I'm in my 60s, you know, that bothers me. I feel exposed. And I think more than anything else, this incident brought that out. And I saw it. You know, I'm afraid, you know, of maybe getting older, but I'm also afraid of people thinking I'm not competent anymore, right? And I discovered something about myself. I could see it right there. So, you know, koan training is wonderful because, you know, often we have so many defenses. We can't, even when things happen, you know, basically we could say, you know, well, it was the building's fault. But actually it wasn't the building's fault. You know, it is a crazy building. But that wasn't why I was upset, right? I was upset because I was afraid that my competence, I was losing my competence, right? That's what frightened me, that these people would think, uh-oh, you know, it's time for him to retire, right? He can't even find a room, you know? That's what frightens me, you know? So I saw it. And it's something I work on the cushion and off the cushion. But unless I were disoriented like that, I never would have seen it. And so, you know, this Zen practice is so beneficial because you're in samadhi. And by the way, my insight into this came on the cushion. After this happened, I wanted to blow it off just like everybody else. But later, I think it was like a Wednesday night sit. I was sitting there and I realized, oh, that's what's bothering me, right? That's why I'm so afraid. So you know, we all have barriers. Some of them are perceptual habits. Not all of them are existential issues, you know, personal issues. Some of them have to do with habits of thinking, habits of perception. But, you know, the koan practice is designed to take you sometimes to that place. And you suddenly see it. And every time you get to that place, nobody likes that place. You know, but then you realize, oh, now I understand. I'm afraid of this, you know. What am I going to do about that? You know, what am I going to do about that? I have to do something about that. And you go through that, and then your world is a bigger world. It's not pleasant, but it's so valuable. And as I was saying earlier, you know, Zen masters look for opportunities to be stymied in order to grow, right? So the attendant is terrified that, you know, he wants to be a good attendant. He, you know, being the, I was Genki Roshi's attendant, I wanted to be a good attendant. So he would say, this is one of the things about Japanese Zen I don't approve of. You know, so I think Chinese monks and nuns have higher standards than, in many ways, than Japanese monks and nuns. So my teacher said, please go get me some sake. So he sent me out for liquor, which is a violation of the precepts, if I may say so. And I don't approve, you know. But I loved my teacher, my shifu, and so I went and got him sake. And I brought it back, and he said, this is not the sake I asked you to get. So I had to go back to the store. I said, oh, I'm so sorry, you know. So I got him the sake he liked. Okay. So I wanted to be a good Inji-san. And this Inji-san wants to be a good Inji-san. And he's afraid to let the Roshi know the fan is broken. We don't know who broke it, but he feels personally responsible. He feels like he's failed. And the teacher is trying to liberate him. The teacher is saying, look, screw the fan, you know. Bring me the rhinoceros. See? That's so great. He says, so it's broken. Do something, you know, do something, you know. And this is the student's chance, right? He could have brought him an umbrella. He could have brought him a pair of shoes. He could have put his shoes on his head, right? You know, show me you're not stymied. You know, we all get stymied, but we, you know, how do we become like the Buddha? Do we become like the Buddha by wearing robes? Do we become like the Buddha by walking around with a mysterious look on our face? You know, do we become like the Buddha? The koan says, you can go, now tell me, you know, you can live the same life as the Buddha and you can die the same death as the Buddha, you know. You know, what would that mean? And what it means is, you know, basically encountering your obstacles, right? And then, you know, realizing there's always something to work with. There's always something to work with. You know, when I was training with my second teacher, Webb Roshi, you know, something went wrong. I think it was in the kitchen. I think I was, you know, Webb said, look, you know, you're bad. There's always, you know, there's always something you can use in your bag, you know, in your bag of tricks. You know, there's always something you can do. When you imagine yourself as helpless and stymied, that's your own mental image. You know, you can find, there's always something you can do. How do you find it, though? You go into deep mushin, deep wushin. So, you know, the way to live the Buddha's life is to face your challenges and then sit down on the cushion and go into deep mushin and allow your active unconscious, your big mind, to kick in and guide you through the process, And, you know, at the end of that, you'll know what to do. You'll be able to do something. I mean, maybe the attendant, you know, if the attendant had been like Joshu, like Jiaozhou, he would have been able to put his shoe, you know, just instantly respond, because his relationship with his big mind was so, he had such an intimate relationship. You know, today, everybody had an intimate relationship this morning with your big mind. Now imagine doing that for 40 years and you will be a Joshu. You will be like the Buddha. You know, the Buddha had to face terrible things. He actually had to live through a genocide. You know, don't kid yourself. He had to do some zazen, you know. But to walk in the Buddha's shoes is to do what we're doing. It's to encounter obstacles, go into big mind, wait for instructions and guidance, and then when it comes, act on that. So this is like two for the price of one, two teishos for the price of one. Just a little bit, so you relax, it's not going to be another hour. A monk came to the master of Toho Hermitage and said to him, if on this mountain you were suddenly to meet a tiger, what would you do? The master went, ah! See, he roared like a tiger. The monk pretended to be frightened. The master roared with laughter. The monk said, you old thief. The master said, try as you may, you cannot do anything to me. The monk stopped short. So the monk is trapped by the, he's supposed to do something, right? Try as you might, you can't do anything to me. So the monk is trapped. He's stymied. He should have slapped his face or pulled his nose, although please don't do that in Dogasan. But what the master of Toho Hermitage is demonstrating his deep intimacy with his big mind. So let's keep cultivating that.